Yo.
Mr. E back on the mic again, interviewing Tracy Twyman, who has an interesting background writing and publishing her own magazine, starting at age 18, and she's put out a number of books after that. So, Tracy, how's it going?
Everything's going great. Very nice to meet you. Thanks for having me on the show.
We also have with us today Demi Deessis. You want to give a shout out to your people, Demi?
Hi there.
All right. So, Tracy R. Twyman, I guess it all began in Oregon, huh? Where you grew up. You were writing for The Bridge, the Portland Community College newspaper, starting at age 16. Did you have any interest in Masonic history before that? I'm guessing that that's what you're writing when you're writing for The Bridge.
Well, yeah, I had just probably a few months before I started writing for The Bridge, I had learned about Freemasonry and their influence on the history of the United States mainly. And that sort of got me started on reading alternate history books, I guess, about the United States. And I guess you would call it conspiracy theories, but, you know, I really sort of early on kind of figured out that there were a lot of different stories and but a common thread amongst all of them, and that if I started really doing research, I could figure out what was real and what was fantasy. My point is that I from the very beginning, I treated it very seriously. I knew that I was looking for truth and that I wasn't just entertaining myself, you know. And I started writing about, I guess my first article was about the possibility that AIDS was a bioweapon. Mm-hmm. And put that right in the school newspaper. And I was a pretty controversial writer there right away. I started getting a lot of letters, and they put me in charge of the opinion page column right away. And you know, I got a lot of experience there in writing and journalism and doing really serious research. I worked there for 2 years, and yeah, I just got a lot of experience in that stuff. And at one point, I came across the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And I learned about alternate European history from that. And that just really opened my eyes. That really got me interested in learning not just about what was going on in my own country, but what is the alternative history of the world? And what's the real influence of secret societies and strange religious beliefs on our leaders and our history? So at that point, it was really something kind of mystical happened to me, where I felt like this was sort of my mission in life. At the time, that's how I felt, that I need to penetrate this mystery of the Holy Grail and the Grail bloodline and the secret societies associated with it. And this idea came to me while I was researching. I was studying for a calculus exam the next day, actually. And instead of studying, I was sitting there just sort of channeling this idea for a magazine about the Holy Grail, and specifically it was going to be try to persuade the reader that this magazine is produced by the Priory of Zion. It was produced by a secret society front organization for the Priory of Zion. And so that was the idea in me putting it together. It was sort of, I was inventing my own form of propaganda. I was pretending that this organization really existed. I sort of believed that it did, but I wasn't actually affiliated with it. And that I really believed that the Grail bloodline, going back to Jesus and perhaps other historical figures, had this right to rule Europe and perhaps all of the world, you know. And I just sort of invented this mindset, this eschatology that I thought, if a person like this exists, this is what they would believe. And then I started backing it up with my own research. And as the years wore on, I did put Dagobert's Revenge out, and I did produce it for several years. I started doing even more serious research on this topic and kind of dropped a lot of the pretense and just started doing really lengthy articles about this topic. And I feel like I really sort of figured it out in a way. I over the years, I think I figured out what all of the symbolism in the story of the Holy Grail means, what the Priory of Sion was trying to say about secrets they allegedly hold in their archives, and also these legends of a Grail bloodline. I think I figured out what that's about too, and it's not just going back to Jesus, it's going back all the way to the beginnings of human history. It's going back to what people call the Nephilim, the fallen angels that supposedly bred with human women. So that's where my research led. It started off, you know, with this kooky idea that I'm gonna put out this propaganda magazine on behalf of the Priory of Sion. And it ended up with doing serious research into the hidden history, not only of Europe, but the world, and sort of comparative religion, comparative mythology, trying to find a common thread amongst all those things. So that's the early part of my career, I suppose.
So, Tracy, I know about the history of the Masons, let's say, going back to the builders of the Gothic cathedrals, mm-hmm. who, with the compass and the square, were able to achieve these engineering feats by trial and error. Build it steeper, build it so steep that it collapses, step back, build it with the most steep angle you can to create these impressive, awesome structures. And, you know, that's how I see the roots of Freemasonry. Now, is this other branch of Freemasonry that's talked about in like Holy Blood, Holy Grail, does that have a connection with the Gothic cathedral builder Masons?
Yes, absolutely. Freemasonry actually, from my research, goes all the way back to ancient Sumeria. But as far as the connection with the Priory of Sion, the Grail bloodline, the first Masonic lodge that's recognized, really, is Roslyn Chapel in Scotland. It was called Lodge Number 1. And that was built by the patronage of the Stuart kings in Scotland. And they were sort also the patrons of Freemasonry in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And they were of the Grail bloodline. It's sort of the British branch of the Grail bloodline, the Stuart kings were. So they were associated with Freemasonry from the very beginning. And this Priory of Sion that is alleged to exist, alleged to go back to the time of the Templars. Actually, they say the Templars were their military arm. You know, of course, the Templars are sort of forebears of the Freemasons. There's a lineage there from Freemasonry down back to Templarism. Mm-hmm. All those things are connected. The Priory of Sion, the Templar, and the Freemasons, sort of the same strain of tradition. And what was specifically your question?
Well, it was the connection between these builders. I mean, that's a public version of Freemasonry that's presented in a history book. So that's how I know about it.
Oh, well,
whole other history of Freemasonry that's kind of a secret history, because I sure didn't read that ever growing up in any book.
I think that Freemasonry is really perceived by outsiders as being one specific thing, when it's very much a loose body of traditions. And there's many different strains of Freemasonry, really. It's kind of like, it's comparable to how Catholicism really has stretched, has spawned a lot of different offshoots. And some of these claim direct lineage back to the Catholic Church and the Pope. You know, there's some bishops out there in the world today practicing their own rites of Catholicism, but because they were properly ordained by a real Catholic bishop or someone, they're from a lineage of people that have been properly ordained, they consider themselves to be legitimate. And the Catholic Church really has never repudiated the fact that these wandering bishops, as they're called, are legitimate also. In a similar way, the Templars really are the founders of all modern secret societies, or most of them. Most of the the ones that really have some, you know, power and influence behind the scenes in our world today, claim some sort of lineage going back to the Templars. And the thing is that on an occult level, that lineage is going to be legitimate for every single one of those groups that claims a connection, if there is a connection. If one person from the original Templars handed down the secrets to someone else, or you know, tapped that person, anointed that person, and then that person anointed someone else, that's a legitimate magical current, as they call it. That's a legitimate stream. So you've got tons of organizations now that are legitimate continuers of the traditions of the Templars, and the same is true of Freemasonry. I mean, Freemasonry is one of those strains, and then in itself has spawned several different other strains. It's really just a body of traditions and rituals that can be interpreted and reformed in many different ways. So that's why I often defend Freemasonry, because I think that the belief that all of these people are involved in some sort of conspiracy is totally wrong. And also I think that some of the Masonic conspiracies that have occurred in the past, from the judgment of modern history, were not evil. You know, anyone who conspires to revolt against the current system, to dethrone the king, is part of a conspiracy, because it's illegal at that time. Right. But afterwards, and when you reform the government, you know, that revolution is perceived as being, you know, the beginnings of your country's history. It's looked on as when you gained independence. So it's not, I don't perceive the American Revolution to have been evil, and it was definitely a Masonic conspiracy, you know. So I guess that's my point. There's a lot of, I'm friends with tons of Freemasons, and I think that there are political movements forming inside some lodges, but I also think that you know, a lot of them are totally apolitical, and you know, and then there's some that are totally rogue, like P2 in Italy, and then they also had influence in South America, and totally just running mafia government there. And it's a Freemasonry, because people go there and sort of bond to each other and agree to back each other up on things, and also because they're keeping each other's secrets, it's the perfect place for a conspiracy to form. It's also the perfect place for a revolution to form that, you know, may be positive in nature. So, you know, I guess a lot of people think that there's something wrong with people meeting in secret. I don't agree, but that's just my opinion.
Well, what I'd wonder is, how can you prevent people from meeting right in secret? This is impossible, to my knowledge. The book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, do you agree with it overall?
Gosh, I guess not, probably, at this point. You know, I think that they were strung along by the Priory of Zion. I don't even agree with my own book now, okay? Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, as the years go on, I learn more and I revise my opinions. So I know that the authors of that book, you know, revised their opinions too, especially Henry Lincoln, one of the three authors, went on to basically recant a lot of the things that were written in the book. But no, the controversy has to do with the Priory of Zion and whether the people that claim to represent it now actually have any connection to the Templars or to the Order of Zion that is recorded in history, that did exist in the 1400s at least. We know that they had a preceptory in Jerusalem, and it was an order of monks. Well, is that organization really connected, as they claim it is, to the modern organization that was registered in France in 1956? Most people today, most researchers, don't think it is connected. I think it's possible that it is connected on some level, having to do with what I just described about, you know, the magical current, the lineage that isn't necessarily recorded in the history books, but was passed down from one person to another. I actually think that there's probably more than one Priory of Sion, and that they all, you know, have some claim of legitimacy that might be based on something. You know, you can't, as an outsider, really know. I think that people are looking for the Priory of Sion to be like the Freemasons, to be, you know, a really verifiable group of people that actually does things, you know? And I think that that's erroneous. I think that a lot of the secret societies that exist don't have regular meetings. They don't do things in public very often. They don't even do things together very often. And what it really consists of is people that have taken an oath at one time and have agreed to all be a part of something. And the thing then exists spiritually. You know, there's a spiritual bond between them all. And that is what the secret society is for the most part. The Priory of Sion, even if it's something that's only existed since the 50s, is still an intergenerational thing that's been going on. You know, they've been putting out information, claiming to know the secret history of Europe, the secret history of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. They've been claiming that there's a treasure buried in southern France that has to do with the Holy Grail. They've been claiming this since the 1950s. So if it's a hoax, as a lot of people claim it is, why are they doing this? I'm not saying it isn't a hoax, but it's a really weird one. You know, why have they been dangling this in front of the public for so many years? Why are so many people involved in it and they're not making any money off of it? So I don't really know what it's about, but I think it's something occult. I think that people are looking at it from the wrong perspective, that if you were an occultist, you would understand it better, that they're doing something magical. Okay, that's I guess my way of summarizing it at this point.
The Holy Blood, Holy Grail talks about the Merovingian bloodline and Jesus as being the root of that bloodline. Now you're saying it goes back farther in history. Do you think Jesus, in his lost years, you know, that they don't talk about in the Bible, do you think that he received initiation into a secret society?
Yes, I think that's very likely. I think that Jesus was continuing a hidden tradition, and that the exoteric interpretation of what he's doing has always been wrong. I think that the best way of understanding Jesus probably is to read the book Jesus the Magician. I think that he was involved in doing occult rituals.
Jesus the Magician, who wrote that?
I think the guy's last name was Morton. I don't have it on me. It's actually out of print. It's hard to find, but it goes through all of these texts about Jesus performing magical rituals, and then later Gnostic texts that were really rituals for people to do where they call on the name of Jesus. And this is, you know, shortly within 100 years. After Jesus's death. So we're talking about, you know, or very early traditions. There's Jewish traditions that basically say that's the reason why he was killed, is because he was a magician, you know? So I think that that's the proper way to interpret Jesus's ministry is from an occult perspective. Yes, go ahead.
And I was always kind of curious about the numerology in the Bible, especially when Jesus supposedly was crucified. Didn't he die at age 33?
Yes.
And is there any significance to that?
Well, 33 is an important number to the Freemasons, and they have 33 degrees in the Scottish Rite. Although they only publicly acknowledge 32, and the 33rd degree is this mysterious thing that there's theories about what the ritual is. I can tell you what I think, and it might tie into the Jesus thing somehow. Mm-hmm. From my research, it seems to me that the 33rd degree ritual is one in which you, because Freemasonry is basically, especially Scottish Rite, it's about becoming a magician. It's about becoming an alchemist, and you learn how to manipulate reality over as you progress through the degrees. And after you get to the 32nd degree, they stop telling you, they stop instructing you on what to do, and you have to figure it out on your own. You initiate yourself into the 33rd degree. When you realize that you are 33rd degree, that's when you're 33rd degree. You know, that's what I think it is.
Yeah, I've always been intrigued by that. For instance, I have a friend. He became a Freemason at the youngest age that he could because, as he told me, his great-grandfather was 32nd degree and gave him the advice when he was a little kid that if he wanted to rise to the 32nd degree, he'd have to start as young as possible and just work up through the ranks. So he did. But this person that I used to collaborate with when I was younger, he expressed that the Freemasons were to him a philanthropic and social organization that he was making connections through to better himself.
Right. Yeah, I think that, you know, when I'm describing them as learning magic, some of them understand that and some of them don't, you know. they're learning, but only a few of them who are really aware know what they're learning. But what I think the purpose that it really serves in a community is they're sort of doing magic on behalf of the community. If they're there, if it's your town lodge and they're meeting on the full moon every month, part of what they're doing really is sort of cleansing the town itself. They're like in charge of, they've appointed themselves, but they're in charge of maintaining the well-being of the town through magic. And so the rituals that they're doing have that effect, even if a lot of them aren't aware of what they're doing.
Yeah, that's an excellent explanation. Very interesting. I've never really heard that explanation given before.
Neither have I. I came up with it myself, but I think it's true.
Well, it's nice to meet an original thinker. So you published Dagobert's Revenge starting at age 18 for, you're saying, like, what, 5 years or so?
Yeah, it was out for about 6 years, and it really sort of, it started with a bang, but fizzled because I didn't really have a budget at the time to keep doing it. So after the first issue, we didn't have another one for a while. But when I started putting it out again, it really caught on in the late 90s. I remember I took the second issue over to some record stores in New York, and like they were apprehensive, but they put some on their shelves. And then I came back the next week, and they said that they had all sold out in record time, and they ordered more. And I was really surprised because I just thought this is the kookiest thing in the world. I had talked to some other people who put out zines, and they were just so bitter about it. They said, oh, it costs so much money and no one reads it, you know, you're wasting your time. And then I told them what I wanted to publish a magazine about, and they're like, oh my god, you know. They had been putting out stuff about at least, like, you know, heavy metal bands and things that they thought someone would be interested in, and here I'm talking about something completely esoteric and unheard of. But that's what sold it, you know. The niche audience had never seen anything like it before, and they loved it. So that's, you know, it took off for a while. I was, you know, living a miserly living, mostly off of the proceeds of the magazine, and things were going great for a while. But our last issue, basically, the printer charged us double what he had quoted and held our magazines hostage until we paid him. So I had to max out all these credit cards to pay him. And everything just went downhill from there. And that's why that was the last issue.
Okay, so to move on, you've got a series of books here that I see in the table in front of me. The first one is called The Merovingian Mythos and the Mystery of... How do you pronounce that?
Rennes-les-Châteaux.
And the Mystery of Rennes-les-Châteaux. Tell me about this book real quick. I mean, we've been talking about this subject for a while, but tell me about the content of this book, if you could.
Sure, yeah. This is basically the summation of all the years of research that I did for the magazine. And I come to the conclusion, as I said, that this bloodline goes back to the Garden of Eden, to the serpent that tempted Eve, was really a representation of this race of fallen angels that interbred with humans and created a race of kings. And the first Sumerian kings were hybrids of this interbreeding. And that's sort of where the tradition of kingship came from. And then I show how myths about European kings harken back to this. And especially this particular bloodline, the Merovingians in France, and how that sort of traces of this can also be found in the traditions of all of these secret societies. Not all of them, obviously, but specifically Freemasonry, Templarism, and the Priory of Zion.
Okay, so the book right next to it is, I'm assuming, the second book that you published, which is a Best of Dagobert's Revenge magazine. The book is entitled The Arcadian Mystique.
Right.
And so these are these articles that different people wrote for your magazine and some written by yourself, or what's in this book?
Okay. Well, it's mainly articles by me and also one of the collaborators, Boyd Rice. And it's mostly the best, most hardcore articles. I mean, some of the, in the early issues we had, as I described, some of these sort of propaganda pieces that were meant to be kind of artistic and funny. This has all of the, you know, sort of hardcore research that led up to the writing of the Merovingian mythos that... where we piece together all of these mysteries. I didn't mention, but yeah, in addition to researching this tree of the bloodline, we also researched the history of these alleged artifacts, treasures that are supposed to be buried in Rennes Chateau, which is in southern France, and basically came to the conclusion that that's what's there is this ancient necropolis. Graves of the ancient god kings that are talked about in the Bible. The theory is basically that Cain was the first king, that he was the first human hybrid from this bloodline, and that you can find the Cain figure in the Bible. You can find it in the history of ancient Sumeria, the history of ancient Egypt. They all tell this story of the same figure, and the name is almost the same. Yeah. So the theory is that in Rennes Chateau, there's actually the grave of Cain, and also some of his ancestors, immediate ancestors, and that these people weren't the same as you or I, because they were from this bloodline of fallen angels, whatever they are. If you think they're aliens, I don't know. I don't try to claim that I know what they were, but they weren't human, and they were taller than regular humans. They had radiant white skin and glowing eyes, and they had a lot of properties, abilities that seemed sort of supernatural, at least to the people that were chronicling them at the time. So my theory is that if you... there's a lot of tunnels underneath Rennes Chateau, and that's where people think that the Holy Grail is buried. And... I think it's quite possible, from the hints and allegories of from the local folklore there in Rennes Chateau, it seems they're talking about that there's this grave of Cain underneath there, and lots of other graves. And I think that you might find the bones of maybe a giant, basically something that's human but more than human. You know.
Oh, very interesting. So next to The Arcadian Mystique is a book entitled Solomon's Treasure, The Magic and Mystery of America's Money. And so when did Solomon's Treasure come out?
Well, yeah, in 2005, the year after I published Merovingian Mythos, I just felt like I had really done the Grail subject and I wanted to move on. And in my research, I had learned some interesting things about the history of the $1 bill and some of the symbolism on it. And also, I had learned a lot about alchemy, I guess you would call it, and ritual magic. And I also, when I was much younger, when I was 16 working for the school paper, I had learned about the Federal Reserve and about the fact that they print money out of nothing and then loan it to people with interest due, and how that's how the economy works. It's just this kind of amazing Ponzi scheme scam, you know. But at the same time, there's something magical about it, that as long as the illusion keeps going, it keeps working. And that basically is what ritual magic is. You create an illusion, and if everyone believes it, then it is real. It's real until everyone stops believing it. And the traditions of alchemy really don't have to do just with turning lead into gold, but you have to actually have a sample of gold in order to create it. You have to sort of multiply gold. It's kind of like the loaves and the fishes. And, you know, I don't know if alchemy was ever a real science or not, but I think it's certainly an allegory for how magic works. And when I started looking in 2005 and thinking about the monetary system and how it works, I just thought, you know what, this is alchemy. And come to think of it, since our founding fathers were Freemasons, and a lot of people in positions of power are members of secret societies, I just wonder if maybe the people who designed this had that in mind, that, you know, the Federal Reserve is called the temple because they create money out of nothing, and it's kind of like this magical process. It's one of the slang terms that's used for it in Washington. And you know what? It's real. I mean, they really mean that. And when I started looking at the $1 bill, I realized, okay, there's all these mystical symbols all over it, but it's not just what people think, that, oh, it's a symbol of the evil New World Order conspiracy. No, it's there's something pertaining to the monetary policy and the concept of alchemy here. So I started noticing that the word "in God we trust" sort of implies that you need to trust in the dollar, you know, and that it has God's blessing. So trust in the dollar the way you trust God. The use of the number 13, not only all over the $1 bill, but throughout our history, is pertains to ritual magic. It pertains to Baphomet, which is this symbol that was used in Templar rituals and in Masonic rituals, and it really symbolizes the Philosopher's Stone of the alchemists. So what that means is it symbolizes this essence that is believed to be at the heart of all matter, that can be used to transmute any kind of matter from one thing into another, or to multiply something from a very small amount to a large amount. That really is what the number 13 represents, that concept. And the other things that it says on the $1 bill, it actually uses the number one, or the word one, or unum, Latin for one. There's 13 occurrences of that. And that caused me to think, you know what? Maybe the number one on this bill isn't just used because it's the $1 bill. Maybe they're saying something. And what they're saying is they're talking about unity. They're talking about trying to bind us all together in society and create this sense of unity and connect that to the dollar, because, you know, money passes from one hand to another. It's really the thing that connects us as a society. We don't have much of a history here in America. But money is really what binds us all together. And people even say that, you know, the business of America is business, that's sort of what defines us, and that's how we're known throughout the rest of the world. Our dollar is the reserve currency for the central banks of other countries. And, you know, everyone knows what the $1 bill looks like all over the world. So my point really with that part of the book is that the dollar is a magical talisman, the physical dollar, and the dollar itself, even the electronic ones, are magical representations of gold. they aren't gold, but they're supposed to be as good as gold. And so they have to create all of this magical illusion to try to make people feel that way, that they are as good as gold. And then, you know, the rest of the book, I sort of trace it then back through history. I show how the Templars invented the checking system. So really, fractional reserve lending, which is how the Federal Reserve works, was invented by the Templars. And, you know, then I just take it all the way back to ancient Sumeria. And I show that money has been associated with religion and magical rituals since the very beginning. The first instance of the use of money is in ancient Sumer. In the temple of Ishtar, they had these tokens that you could buy. You would go with your ritual offering of a bushel of wheat, and you give that to the temple. They give you this coin, and then you use that coin to go patronize the temple prostitutes, and that's all part of the ritual. And that's how money was created. So the whole book is really about the esoteric history of money. We start off with America, and then we go all the way back to the beginning of history.
Demidaisis would like to make an interjection.
I was curious about any possible relationship between America's money system and the Rothschild dynasty. Do you have any input on that?
Yeah, a little bit. That the modern incarnation of fractional reserve lending, I said it was kind of invented by the Templars because they invented the checking system in about the 1200s, basically. The 12th century. but the system that we're currently using is really an extension of the system created by the Bank of England. And that was specifically created by the Rothschild family. And really, they sort of invented was this system of, originally they were goldsmiths, and they would literally they were paid to hold people's gold in strong boxes, like, you know, that was originally what a bank was supposed to do, just hold your gold for you, and you pay them a small fee in exchange for doing that to keep it safe from the robbers. And what they discovered was that most people just kept their gold there and didn't check on it very often. Okay, so they came up with this system of loaning people credits that represent the gold that they had in their vaults, but loaning out more gold than they actually had, and of course not asking the people who had given them the gold, you know, whether it was okay for them to loan it out or not. And it was the beginnings of a Ponzi scheme where they came up with this ratio. They said, okay, for every $10 that we loan out worth of gold, or I guess 10 pounds, only one person ever comes to collect theirs. So we can keep this going and keep making money because people will pay back their loans with real money, and we never actually have to have the real money except for 1 pound worth. And somehow this became legitimized over time as this is the way a bank is supposed to operate. And, you know, it's really kind of hard to believe, but that is what happened. That's how our modern economic system was born. And even though some of the founding fathers tried to prevent it from happening here in the United States, eventually it did. Eventually, wars caused us to become indebted to banks that were associated with the Rothschild family. And they forced on us as sort of a condition of that loan that we would have to do it through this central bank that would be privately owned, but orchestrated by the government, or tied in with the government. And what it ended up doing really was controlling the government. What happened was that now we basically have a corporately owned, privately owned government that operates for the profit of a handful of individuals. The monetary system itself basically siphons real wealth out of the hands of the public and channels it into the hands of this banking cartel. And it's covered up through inflation, through printing more dollars than was there before. And every time you do that, it deflates the value of everyone's dollars. But the people that are at the top of the hierarchy, the people that are involved in the banks that get the money issued by the Federal Reserve Bank first, that's called high-powered money. It is worth more when it comes out of the Federal Reserve first than it is later as it gets filtered on down the line. So when they're trying to bring us out of a recession, they inflate the currency to get more money out there. So it's flowing more and there's more liquidity. But what ends up happening, like this last stimulus, is basically most of that money has been trapped in the banking system and on the stock market for the last 2 years. You're not seeing any of it in the real economy, but the bankers and the stock traders on Wall Street are happy. And so that they can claim that there was, you know, that the economy came back last year somehow, that it's a double dip recession instead of being a depression. And then they even invented this weird term, jobless recovery. So it's like, it is magic, you know. The thing is that it stopped working in 2008. And now, basically, the bubble has burst, and everyone's sort of denying it. But it's like when Wile E. Coyote jumps off, or walks off the edge of the cliff, and he's standing there in midair, and he doesn't realize until he looks down that he's just walked off the cliff, and that's when he starts falling. That's what's about to happen to us. And it's already happening to Europe. They are saying that the euro, which is another fiat currency, another magical alchemical currency, is just going to be worth nothing. It's going to collapse within maybe a couple of weeks here. And that could create a ripple effect. It'll strengthen the dollar temporarily because we'll be able to take over we'll be the reserve currency of all those countries again, probably. But in the end, the same thing's going to happen to us. And there's a lot of theories about what's coming after that, you know, some sort of global monetary system possibly.
Oh, that was a mouthful. Okay. Well, I'm going to move on to the next book. I was wondering while we were talking about the forefathers and Freemasonry, but I think we've already covered that. Here's a question I got for you before we move on to your next book. Was there any affiliation between the Rosicrucians and Freemasonry? You know, through that was Benjamin Franklin, you know, interested in Rosicrucianism, free thinker, Freemason also?
Yeah. It was definitely grown out of the Masonic tradition and the Templar tradition. Rosicrucianism really is similar to the Priory of Zion, I think. It started out as a hoax and sort of became legitimate over time. But it was started by this guy that actually the Priory of Zion claims was one of their grandmasters, navigators, they call him. His name was Johann Valentin André. And, okay, it's very similar actually to the beginnings of Dagobert's Revenge. He printed this tract proclaiming that this organization existed, this brotherhood that was going to overthrow all of the thrones of Europe and the Catholic Church and create this sort of mystical new empire throughout Europe that was going to be, how would you describe it? It's like the gnomes are going to be in charge. The wise men are going to guide us into a new age of enlightenment, you know. But yeah, it was the symbols of Rosicrucianism. A lot of them are very similar to Masonic symbols. And in fact, there's a degree of the Rosy Cross in the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. So they're sort of connected. They're almost the same. Sometimes Rosicrucian groups are, in fact, a Masonic group. And sometimes Masonic groups are, in fact, Rosicrucian. So definitely related.
Okay, now we can move on to the main, most exciting topic of today's interview, the book "Mind-Controlled Sex Slaves and the CIA." which you wrote. When did you write this book?
Typical guy, you think that that's the most exciting thing. The mind-controlled sex slaves. Now we're getting into the interesting part. Yeah. Okay, so what was your question again?
Well, first question is, when did you write, you know, and publish this book? And then tell us a little bit about it, please.
Sure. Yeah. A lot of the material came from research I did for an article I wrote for Hustler. And it was basically a lot of interviews that I did with people that claimed that they either were sex slaves for the CIA or had firsthand knowledge of it. So how this works is, try to explain this, okay. How it goes is that the CIA supposedly is running prostitutes to try to compromise politicians and businessmen, people in positions of power that they need to use for one reason or another. And they're choosing to send in people that they've mind controlled because it's easier to control the situation, and also that these people can give the perverted politicians and businessmen exactly what they want because they've been trained to do it exactly that way. You know, they don't have any inhibitions like a normal prostitute might. So the theory is that these people are being mind controlled through rape and torture. There's something called trauma-based mind control. They
multiple personality disorder.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure, hey, your audience probably knows all about this, really. They supposedly it started in Nazi Germany, actually, and they say that it was discovered after we won the war. We went through their records and discovered all this sick research they had done into what happens when you subject a child to rape and torture at a very young age, and how it causes them to break down into multiple personalities that can then be programmed to do whatever you want. And sex slave is really only one incarnation of it. You could also use them for, you know, to be a courier or
a
to
tape recorder.
Yeah, and then as an assassin, some of the obvious things. And there's no reason why a person who's been mind controlled couldn't be used for all three. And some of these people claim that they were used for all three. So the people that I interviewed were Kathy O'Brien, someone who says that she was a presidential model. She said that she was sent in to service most of the presidents of the last several years. And she says that actually because of that, she was given some sort of vaccine that would prevent her from ever getting any sexually transmitted disease.
Like
so, right. So she couldn't pass that on to the important politicians. And she's got some really wild stories. And I found some of them really hard to believe. I also interviewed Noreen Gosh, who's the mother of a kidnapped child. It was a high-profile case in the 80s. And she says that she learned that he was kidnapped by this program. This program is called Project Monarch, supposedly. And it's an extension of MK Ultra, which was a mind control program for the CIA that they admit happened. It was really a bunch of different things. It was an umbrella over all of these different mind control experiments that they were doing. Some of them went beyond experiments, I think. I think they were operational. But, you know, they were doing all sorts of things to people, as you probably know, with drugs and sleep deprivation. And they were doing this all on unwitting subjects, mostly people in mental hospitals and people in jail, other people who were vulnerable. And what I found in my research is that most of the people who appear to have been involved in this sex slave mind control operation, a lot of them were either from families where they were already being sexually abused, and they came into it supposedly because their parents were busted for abusing them, and then the corrupt rogue officials in the government co-opted them into this government sex abuse program. And then others were taken from orphanages and used. So again, we have, you know, the most vulnerable members of society, people that no one really cares about. No family members are going to follow up on what happened to them, and
they've been abused, so they fit the profile too.
Right. I mean, that's something that I even remember in school. They're, you know, they tell you it's important to have good self-esteem and carry yourself as though you're confident and everything, because if you look vulnerable, then that's you're going to be attacked by a predator. And, you know, yeah, people who have already been abused are more likely to be abused by a sexual deviant, including someone working for the government.
Well, that certainly makes sense, especially the part about sexual deviance in the government. Ha ha ha. That was supposed to be kind of a joke, I guess, but whatever. Anyways, here, Demi Diocese, you have something to add to this conversation.
Yeah, interestingly, the word or the phrase Project Monarch really can't be found in any official government documentation, and it wasn't really used until after 1990, mm-hmm. when Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien used it in some documents that they had. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden it seemed like there was just a plethora of revelation as far as Project Monarch and stuff. And do you think there might be some cross-contamination? I believe in that there was something, there was a program that involved children to create multiple personality disorder and to program each of those personalities to do an assigned task or function. And like you said earlier, there were some sub-projects from MKUltra mm-hmm. that kind of fit this description. Mm-hmm. There were about four or five. So what's your take on the whole Project Monarch phenomenon?
Yeah, I've basically come to the conclusion that's probably a made-up term, you know, that Kathy O'Brien injected this into the popular consciousness, and then other people sort of emulated her after that. I think I'll just say it. My opinion of Kathy O'Brien is that she's probably someone who is mentally unstable, maybe has been abused, and maybe with the encouragement of this Mark Phillips fellow who supposedly deprogrammed her and helped her write all of her books about her abuse, I think that she's very deluded. It's impossible to know what, if anything, of her story is true. And then all these other people that seem to have copied her. There's someone
Bryce
named
Taylor.
Bryce Taylor, Cisco Wheeler. There's some others that tell a very similar story to hers, but there's no history of people telling stories really quite like that about being a presidential model or something called Project Monarch. Before that, it seems to have been something started by Kathy O'Brien, and then other deluded women with controlling boyfriends who helped them write books have continued that tradition. And at this point, they all fight with each other and accuse each other of being, you know, part of the Illuminati conspiracy. So it's hard to believe any of them. But just to answer your question as quickly as possible, I do think that there's a difference between Kathy O'Brien's wild stories and the underlying meat of this story, which is that, yes, there's government cooperation with organized crime, and the human trafficking trade is part of that, sex slavery, child pornography and prostitution. They are using those people to compromise politicians. And I think that they use children a lot, because if you got someone on camera doing it with a child, that's something that you can totally use against them. They'll always do what you say. You know, they can't wiggle out of it like they could, like Bill Clinton did with Monica Lewinsky. I don't think that it's necessarily compromising enough anymore just to have someone on camera having sex with someone other than their wife. I think you've got to have them on camera doing something totally abhorrent to society and something very criminal. So I think that that's why they use kids a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's really no explanation for how many kids are kidnapped and go missing, and most of them are killed, except that someone in a position of power is allowing this to happen. What I found was that the FBI does not really pursue any of these missing child cases, and they refuse to release statistics on how many reports they get. Center for Missing and Exploiting Children has been trying to get them to release statistics for years, and they did it once really reluctantly, and they released just barely, just a little bit of information, nothing that could really be used. So I definitely think that there's a conspiracy going on here. It's hard to tell how many of the high-profile cases are real, but I think that if you're unfortunate enough to be in an orphanage, to be taken into foster care, the CPS, Child Protective Services, is totally corrupt. They've been accused and even caught in some cases of actually running a child human trafficking ring. That's the purpose of what they do, is to they take orders for children, and they seek out a child that they want to kidnap. Basically, they find some reason to take them away from the family, and then they're basically given as a foster child to someone that wants to have sex with them. So, I'm going to stop talking now, but that's basically...
As you've been describing kind of an overall profile for who might be subjected to mind control and abuse, it makes me think of Charles Manson. He was an orphan. He grew up on the Boys Ranch, the famous Boys Ranch that they made that movie about in the 40s and stuff. And he's absolutely a mind-controlling predator. That's the MO that for him is so absolutely second nature. It's just who he is. So any connection, in your opinion, between Manson and any of these mind-control victims?
Yeah, I think that the evidence is strong that when he was in Boys Town, which is one of these orphanages that's connected to this CIA mind control program. I think that he might have been subjected to stuff there. And he was at another mental facility, I believe it was called Vacaville,
yes,
in California.
Another CIA mind control
institution. That's a place where it's been declassified that they were doing mind control experiments on unwitting subjects. He was also in and out of prison pretty much his whole life, and there's another vulnerable population. So I think it's totally possible that he was subjected to mind control, and then that may have given him the idea, really, about what to do with the family that he started. I think that, you know, once you yourself are subjected to mind control, you may actually, you know, get the idea to do it to someone else too. But I think Charles Manson is probably one of the unintended consequences of this. This is what I think, is that they did experiment with breaking people down through trauma-based mind control to try to create assassins and sex slaves. But the thing is, you don't know what's going to happen to a person after you do that to them. And they might go off and kill a bunch of people, and you didn't intend for that to happen. Yeah, I think that once you do that, you warp someone's mind like that, you know, the chances of them becoming a sociopath serial killer is very high.
Mm-hmm. And there's a good book by Dave McCowan called Programmed to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murder. And he sort of kind of gives that outline in terms of the individuals that are involved in a lot of these serial killings or serial murders, and you know, how they were institutionalized and how they fit that typical, stereotypical type profile.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Demi de Assis. We can continue on. Well, actually, I'll ask you a question here, Tracy. You have a section in your book about Noreen Gosh, whose son was kidnapped, something that obviously any mother is going to be extremely traumatized about. And it turned into this whole kind of mind control story involving this male prostitute in Washington, D.C., Jeff Gannon, who was named a journalist, was kind of a journalist liaison for the White House with no journalism background at all, really, except for a high school yearbook. I mean, that's just such a strange story that... What's your opinion about this whole matter?
Okay, well, basically, the story of Johnny Gosch is this paperboy who was kidnapped in the 80s and never seen again. No one really knows what happened to him, but his mother, went on a crusade to find out what happened. She said she didn't get any cooperation from the police, and ended up being contacted by people that she was told were CIA agents and people who told her they were from the FBI. And then one real former FBI agent, Ted Gunderson, who I also interview for the book. Anyway, it seems like at some point she was turned on to the idea that he might have been a victim of this Project Monarch. I don't know if she even called it that, but or something similar to that. She basically became of the opinion that he'd been kidnapped by a government-sponsored child trafficking ring and that he was being prostituted to politicians and also used in satanic rituals, which is a aspect of the story that we really haven't discussed. But most of the stories about people who say that they've had this done to them said that satanic rituals were part of their victimization, that sometimes when they were being raped, it was part of a satanic ritual. And, you know, I don't know entirely what to make of that, but I think it's possible that there's a connection there. It has to do with connections between the occult and mind control. Mind control is really like an occult process in a way. And there's a lot of confluence between government, especially intelligence and secret societies. And some of them are pretty dark.
Curious.
Yeah, some of them are very into things that definitely seem like Satanism and conjuring demons and worshiping them and things like that. So I guess what I'm saying, basically, what I've discovered is that there's this milieu, this very dark milieu, where mafia, organized crime, people who are into having sex with children, and intelligence and occultism, all these people kind of are friends with each other and move in the same underworld. It's because it's the underworld that they all know each other, basically, I think. And anyway, that's what Noreen Gosh said, that she, you know, was of the opinion, basically, that that's what had happened to her son. And then she told me in the interview that this suspicion was finally verified when he came back to her house one night as an adult. And he supposedly escaped from the cult and told her all these stories about what had happened to him that matched what she had thought. And then he said, well, I'm on the run and I can't stay. So, you know, maybe someday I'll talk to you later. And he left. And she hasn't seen him since. And at the time I interviewed her in 2001, that was the rest of the story. And I thought that, you know, her story might be plausible. You know, I'm not about to automatically discount the story of someone who says their child was kidnapped. That gives her some level of credence where it's hard for me to understand why she would lie about it, you know. So sort of believed her in 2001. Time goes on and some more weird things happen. You mentioned Jeff Gannon. Well, 2005, yeah, this incident with Jeff Gannon occurs. And just to remind the audience, basically this guy was asking George Bush questions in the White House press room that the other reporters thought were kind of softball leading questions. And then they realized that they didn't recognize this guy. And of course, they all know each other. So, you know, they're journalists. So they did some research and figured out, okay, this guy isn't much of a real journalist. I mean, he had a blog, but, you know, yeah, like you said, there's no real reason for him to be there. And then the other thing they discovered about him is naughty pictures of him on the internet as a military-themed male prostitute. And, you know, so they embarrassed him publicly and accused George Bush of, you know, setting this whole thing up. And then around the time this happens, Noreen Gosh does an interview for a newspaper in Utah, one of those alterna news weeklies, like Village Voice kind of, you know, where she says that Jeff Gannon looks like the guy that visited her and claiming to be Johnny Gosh as an adult. And, you know, I can see why in her mind it would all fit together if she really recognized him and thought, oh, that's the guy that came and visited me in my house. Then you put it all together, and it's kind of an interesting story. You know, this kid gets kidnapped by this sex slave ring that we've described, and then ends up in the White House and has been a male prostitute, military themed, you know. It seems believable that if someone had gone through something like that, that's what they would turn into. Well, the thing is that Jeff Gannon is older than Johnny Gosch would be and claims to be himself. he has a, that's not his real name. His real name's James Guckert. But, you know, he has a real life and he says he's not Johnny Gosch and there's no reason to disbelieve him. But interesting thing, after that article came out that Noreen Gosch was interviewed for in that newspaper in Utah, the newspaper went out of business within about 2 days and came back the next week with a different name and they had fired all the staff. So they didn't like that they had published that article. Of course, that doesn't really prove anything, but it's just an interesting aspect to the story. So anyway, this thing with Jeff Gannon throws a bad light on Noreen Gosch, because you'd think that if this guy had visited you, that you would recognize him. And, you know, well, maybe he did. Maybe he's really an agent and it really was Jeff Gannon that visited her, but he isn't really Johnny Gosch. I don't know. You'd have to go that far to believe that she's telling the truth. Well, now she says that she never even accused Jeff Gannon of being Johnny Gosch, even though for actually a year or so, she and Ted Gunderson were challenging him to present his DNA to prove he's not. So anyway, and then there's just one more thing about that happened with Noreen Gosch that was sort of the nail in the coffin that made me think, okay, this poor woman is really insane, is that someone sent her some pictures of her son, claiming the pictures of her son right after he was kidnapped, all tied up on a bed. And it looks like this sick, you know, intro to a child porn S&M scene. But she went on television asking people to give her details about where the scene is from, if they recognize the house, anything like that, to try to track down who took the picture. And the public came forward and they did figure out where the picture came from and who the child was in the picture. And it wasn't Johnny Gosch. And apparently it was all just play acting. Someone was playing, pretending to tie someone up and took a picture of it. And someone was obviously having fun at Noreen Gosch's expense, sending her this picture. But the thing is, you know, she believed it. She said, "That looks like my son." And that's kind of weird, because surely even if she's forgotten what her son looks like after all these years, she's got pictures of him. Oh, yeah. You know, what? I mean, I looked at pictures of Johnny Gosch and pictures of this kid, and I could tell it was not that kid.
Right.
So I don't know what to think of this woman. She's, you know, obviously a victim, and I feel sorry for her, but, you know, she seems kind of crazy. And it's sorry to say, we still don't know what happened to Johnny Gosch, and he may very well be part of this program, who knows. But, yeah, I just don't know what to make of her. And Ted Gunderson, too. It's like, he keeps making claims that don't turn out to be true. He seems like a nut. I don't know what to make of this stuff. It's like researching it led me into this path where I discovered that, oh my God, there's all of this human trafficking going on, all this sex slavery, and the patrons of it seem to be rich people in positions of power, and they seem to have people in the government covering up for them. And that all seems to be real, and there may very well be connections to intelligence and mind control too. But as far as the people who have come forward claiming to have been victims of it, very few of them seem credible. The only ones that I still say seem kind of credible are the kids in the Franklin cover-up in Nebraska that testified and actually even got a settlement at one point. Paul Bonacci, who testified against Larry King and other people involved in abusing him in Nebraska, got a settlement at one point from a judge who believed him. But then another judge convicted him and some other of the kids making these accusations, convicted them of perjury, put them in jail. And, you know, I still have no reason to disbelieve that they're telling the truth.
And several of those teenagers who became adults were actually either killed or supposedly committed suicide.
Right.
But the circumstances were really sketchy in at least two of the deaths, from my understanding.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably the end that most of these children met. And I think that that's why the people that are coming forward with their books and their seminars are so unbelievable, is because, hey, you would be dead if this happened to you, probably, mm-hmm. you know. As we all know, if a child goes missing for 72 hours, they're presumed dead. You know, that's usually what happens when people kidnap children. They have sex with them and they bury them in the backyard or sell them off to some ring that, you know, makes snuff films out of them, passes them around, and then buries them in the backyard when they're done with them. The disturbing thing is to realize that that's happening on a really massive scale and not a lot is being done about it. It's kind of hard to believe that something like that could go under the radar. But when I started looking into especially things happening overseas in Europe and England, I was shocked to realize the level that it's going on at and how people in society know about it, but they can't do anything about it because of the corruption. The thing is, the reason why there's so many stories to follow in Europe is because the press over there covers it, mm-hmm. you know, and it becomes a scandal. There was a scandal in Portugal with a orphanage that was caught prostituting children to all the politicians in the area. And there was another one in Guernsey on the Channel Islands, similar situation. And in Northern Ireland, they actually convicted MI5 agents of doing this, of prostituting children so that they could compromise people and get them on camera having sex with children. I mean, you know, we're talking about things that are in The Guardian and The Times of London and mainstream newspapers. So it was shocking to me in my research to realize how much government corruption is allowing children to be prostituted and trafficked.
That's an excellent point. I mean, there's so much media cover-up that occurs through just not being willing to touch different subjects and pressures that are put on journalists to censor themselves, that it becomes really hard to know what's real. But those examples of European child sex slave rings, that's alarming stuff.
Yes.
And we're getting towards the end of our interview. I'm going to pass the mic around. And everyone, that is Tracy Twyman, and Demi Deassis, and myself, Mr. E, we can all make parting comments and or any other points or interjections that we wish to make. So I'm going to hand the mic first to Demi Deassis, and then Tracy Twyman, and then I'll wrap things up. Here you go, Demi.
Yeah, Tracy, I really appreciate you bringing a lot of these topics out, and I found it really intriguing, very interesting. Are there any classes that you can take, like at a college, on some of these subjects? I think it'd be great if they offered them.
Actually, there's a guy in town here who teaches at Portland Community College that contacted me about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months ago. And he has a writing 121 class, you know, just like a remedial writing class, that he teaches from the perspective of trying to introduce students to esoterica and conspiracies. Okay. And it's really, I'm shocked that this guy still has a job. mm-hmm. But he's doing it. He makes these kids read books and write essays, so they're learning about reading and writing. But in the process, they're learning about all sorts of shocking revelations about hidden history and, I think that's how it's got to be done, because there might be some novelty classes in some colleges about esoteric history, but for the most part, there's certainly not a degree that you can get. And in fact, when I was in college, it was like I got really good marks, but I didn't get encouraged to pursue this angle at all. Then again, I guess just my parting thought on that topic is that I think that modern education is a total scam. So I think that the best you can do if you really want to know about things is you got to educate yourself, read books, look at the internet, figure it out on your own, because there's, it's not worth your dollar, I don't think, to learn history or anything in college. If you want to go to college, you know, learn some useful trade, but to pay someone to tell you what books to read, I think is pretty lame, even though I went to college.
Well, interestingly, we all went to college here. Myself, Mr. E, Demi Deassis, you, Tracy Twyman, we all have degrees. Well, I was a older college student, and I sat in on classes when I was younger. Classics at Berkeley, world religions at Seattle University, ethnomusicology at the University of Washington. This is all before actually getting credit for college. So, you know, I would have been glad to do that, but finally I just decided to go and get the piece of paper. So was it worth it? Because I'm very independent in creating my own ideas and projects, it was worth it. As far as looking at school in general, I have to view it as socialization of the masses. And so I want to see the kids having fun socializing with each other. And I hate to see the children who are outcasts and who this socializing environment just isn't any fun for. So, you know, school has this interesting definition in my mind. I see it very much in a utilitarian way, and it's certainly not for just the goal of educating oneself, really. School, I guess in my viewpoint, that is in the viewpoint of Mr. E, the mystery man. School originally was made for the purpose, well, but this is a viewpoint of Buckminster Fuller's, and I agree with him, that schools originally were made to give people specialized knowledge, but not overall understanding. If you give people components of knowledge, but don't let them see the overview of knowledge, then really they're compartmentalized, and whoever has that overview can control them more easily. So that's I'm paraphrasing in my own words, but still that's the gist of the Fuller's idea about education. So I agree with that. And I'm really pleased to have met you today, Tracy Twyman. I've heard about you before through Demi Deassis, and now I'm meeting the real person, and Demi and I have had a very interesting adventure doing interviews and radio shows, and I've had a chance to meet some different conspiracy researchers and alternative history researchers, secret history researchers and writers, and these are always dynamic people who are fascinating for me. So I really appreciate it, Tracy. Good luck with your writing and research in the future. Thank you, Demi Deassis, for bringing me here. And this has really been an excellent interview. It's time to wrap things up, though, and roll on down the highway, as the old song goes, because we've got another interview to do later on today. So, on that note, this is Mr. E, once again saying over and out.